This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on Community Radio 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change.
It's Easter Monday, 2026, and peace is in the air, isn't it? Over 45 countries and civil society groups are now heading to Colombia. But it's in the middle of a hideous oil and gas crisis caused by a hideous war on Iran, which is killing people, crushing buildings, and creating climate-changing emissions in the very first 2 weeks, which are equivalent to the annual emissions of a country like France. Are the people at the Santa Marta conference going to talk about how to do deals to keep our dependence on oil and gas? No. We will talk to Dr. Simon Bradshaw about how a well-managed transition to renewables will also bring peace. With Greenpeace, he's been to many Talanoa meetings in the Pacific, and the message is always, we are all in the same canoe. Then we'll hear from Climate and Energy Minister Chris Bowen, who has also been to many a Talanoa in the Pacific. And we're going to hear some of his ideas as president of negotiations for COP31. Lastly, we'll hear actor Rosie Wiley read Bill McKibben's article on how China is leading the way by building up solar-powered independence in poor, besieged Cuba. But first, to set the scene, here are three journalists from Covering Climate Now on the oil crisis in the Middle East.
I've been in Saudi Arabia and I've been in Qatar, and I've seen these gas and oil terminals. And you've got to think of massive, three, four, five, six, seven times the size of football parks, even bigger, with hundreds and thousands of pipes and things. There are massive facilities. Saudi Aramco, Qatar Liquefied National Gas, Qatar Petroleum. Of course, you have the same in Kuwait, in Emirates. They're massive. So I know what we're seeing and what we're hearing is that drones, I mean, nowadays, modern warfare, you can have a drone that costs $10,000 being used by Iran, and it's being shot down by Patriot interceptory missiles that are costing $500,000, $1 million a pop. There's an argument that Iran haven't used yet all of their facilities or all of their military drones, but just one of these drones striking one of those oil or gas installations, I could imagine it would be quite a really serious issue. And I can imagine that's why they're being shut down. But one strike on one of those facilities would be, in environmental terms, a big problem for the gas leak or the oil spill. And also in economic and financial terms, shutting these things down.
Just remember the pictures we had from Iraq in 1990 and 2003, you know, with the fires coming out of those oil places.
I asked the journalists at the webinar whether all of this crisis has made the transition away from fossil fuels almost unthinkable.
Radio 3CR in Sydney, Australia, mentions the conference that's going to take place at the end of April, the so-called first international conference on the just transition from fossil fuels. This is an initiative that actually grew out of the UN COP30 climate summit in November, where petrostates led by Saudi Arabia blocked 85 countries at the climate summit who wanted to begin to devise a roadmap to phase out fossil fuels. 85 countries were on the record for that, but the UN climate summit operates under the United Nations rules. Those rules mandate that it is consensus decision-making. Consensus is not the same as unanimous, but it does mean that a small handful of states can block what the majority wants. That's what happened in November. But now, in April, in Colombia, those same 85 countries are going to be invited to a conference to pursue the same roadmap. And crucially, this conference will not be taking place under UN rules that allow consensus to block progress, but rather majority rules. So the question, with that as background, the question from Australia is, are these oil wars making it unthinkable for the world to transition away from fossil fuels? I'm going to give each of you about 30 seconds to answer that. Let's start with you, Nina.
The Santa Marta Conference is a place for countries, cities, indigenous peoples, academics, etc., to come, who are ready to talk about implementing strategies and policies to transition away from fossil fuels. It isn't a negotiation space. It's a place where the idea is to make evidence-based policy on how to transition, on solutions on how to transition away from fossil fuels. So you're going to see coming together at Santa Marta, cities, states, lawmakers, peasant farmers, unions, young people who will have ideas or already putting into practice at at local levels, solutions from transition away. But this is an action orientated conference. It's going to be the first of many, the organizers hope. And these are the countries who have said that, you know what, we have to act now. We need to share ideas and policies and strategies, measures, and we need to work on ways and how to accelerate these. The majority of people in the world want climate action. They want to transition away from fossil fuels. They can see what's happening to the planet. I think it makes it much harder for those countries. The people going to this conference represent by far the majority of the population of the world. They're going to be talking about action and implementation.
Okay, so it's not unthinkable, says Nina. And she's referencing there the 89% project of Covering Climate Now, which finds that 80 to 89% of the world's people want their governments to take stronger climate action. To this question, is it unthinkable for us to transition away from fossil fuels or not? Giles.
Slightly negative, I'm sorry, but fossil fuels are a way of amplifying power and projecting force at scale, and militaries are using that. Maybe that's what's behind Donald Trump's drill, baby drill. And so conflict is increasing around the world. And until there are other sources, then I think fossil fuels are going to be difficult to tear some people away from them.
Meanwhile, breaking news from Bogota. Irene Vélez-Torres, the Minister for Environment, noted that the Santa Marta Conference comes at a crucial moment as global energy supplies are challenged by war. She said, the conference will create a favourable condition for moving towards concrete agreements and stronger cooperation between countries with different economic situations. And she's confirmed 45 countries, including exporters like Canada, UK, Norway, and Australia, and countries in the most vulnerable category like Palau and Tuvalu. Also breaking news from New South Wales, the Minns government has announced it will not grant any new licenses to explore for or open greenfield coal mines. Thank you to Rod Campbell at the Australia Institute for this news. Two songs in this program, and they're both by the brilliant musician David Rovix.
Flying in with high tech, overwhelming force. The empire never fights fair, of course. It runs the world in order to do what the billionaires tell them to. With excuses that are patently meaningless, they're killing for corporate interests. And because they have nuclear weapons, and the ones they attack haven't got them there. Invading a sovereign nation's soil in another war for oil. They say that Don is unhinged because he's saying what the real reason was. Not drugs or freedom or democracy. policy, but the interest of U.S. companies. It's the oldest imperial tradition, wiping out or taking over all the competition. Unless you're dumb enough to believe the head of state again, who says he'll make Venezuela great again by invading a sovereign nation's soil in another war for oil. They overthrew Iranian democracy way back in 1953. Decades later, the empire struck back to keep all their oil in Iraq. They even overthrew Australia, Chile, Haiti, Guatemala, Cuba, the DR, and the Congo. Yeah, where did Lumumba go? Invading a sovereign nation's soil in another war for oil. It's a long North American tradition, crimes of imperial sedition, justified by Democratic senators, Woodrow Wilson's very progenitors. If you dare to resist the eagle's claw, you can forget all about international law, because the conventions mean as little to them as they do to the European Union. Invading a sovereign nation's soil.
Is Dr. Simon Bradshaw from Greenpeace. He's the lead person for COP31, and he has a distinguished career as a researcher with the Climate Council and Oxford, and I'm very delighted to welcome him to the Climate Action Show. So welcome, Simon. Look, the world is facing an extreme energy crisis just today. In 3 weeks' time, however, there's a conference in Santa Marta, a coalition of countries willing and committed to eliminate fossil fuel dependence, is preparing to map out how. In the present moment, can you tell us a little bit about your work and also how helpful you think this Santa Marta conference will be?
Well, very good to be with you, Vivian, and thank you for this opportunity to chat about what is a very important conference at a very important moment. Now, I think you've started by, yes, reflecting on this confronting moment we're in globally. And I think, among other things, it really has shown the perils of fossil fuel dependence and how fossil fuels are the underpinning of a lot of conflict and instability in the world. Of course, that's not the only thing that's happening right now. And I think all of our thoughts are, first of all, with those in parts of the Middle East going through a very traumatic time under this latest illegal invasion. But it obviously has brought to the fore the fact that, you know, fossil fuels are a real threat to stability and to peace, and that the only real path to peace and security on the long term is transitioning away from fossil fuels. Now, back to this conference. Well, this really comes to address what's been the fundamental failing of 30 plus years of attempts at global climate cooperation, where, of course, we've seen tremendous progress in the growth of renewable energy and other important solutions, but we've not really made any inroads in curbing fossil fuel production. In fact, fossil fuel use, coal, oil, and gas burning has continued to rise over the last 30 years. It reached a dangerous new high just last year. That's pushed global emissions to frightening new highs, brought us perilously close to crossing dangerous tipping points in the climate system. So we really have an urgent challenge, a survival imperative with getting off fossil fuels. Now, a group of very determined countries last November, after the latest round of global climate negotiations, COP30, you know, failed to reach a decision on accelerating the transition away from fossil fuels. They said, okay, we've got to do better. Let's get together. Let's have the world's first conference dedicated to the practicalities of getting off fossil fuels, and let's sort of set up another coalition of the willing, it's sometimes called. We don't all like that term because people my age, it reminds us of another use of that term not so long ago. But in essence, that's what it is. This is a determined countries led by Colombia, itself a fossil fuel producer, co-hosting this conference with the Netherlands, and with very strong participation from a number of Pacific Island nations who've been, as listeners would know, really at the forefront of efforts to move the world off fossil fuels, coming together in real active leadership, but also to grapple with these challenges and work out how we get off fossil fuels, how we get our emissions down, which it's now very clear is essential to tackling the climate crisis and having a livable planet, but also the path to a more peaceful, prosperous future for all of us.
Yeah, well, you're with Greenpeace, and I know you've had a lot to do with the Pacific, and they want to have 100% renewables. I wonder, Australia will support that at COP31, but will they actually pay for it?
Well, that's getting right to the heart of the challenge, and I think will very much be part of what's being discussed in Santa Marta. I mean, the Pacific has a vision to be 100% fossil fuel free as soon as possible. That's obviously, of course, a real active leadership when it comes to leading the world's transition away from fossil fuels, but importantly, will be really transformative and liberating for the region because it will free communities and nations from expensive diesel fuel imports. It'll support local economies. It really is going to help meet many of the region's development goals. So it's a win-win situation. But it does depend on adequate support and funding from wealthy countries like Australia, who've built a lot of their wealth off fossil fuel production. And this issue of climate finance, international finance to enable that transition, that is always at the heart of these international negotiations. Anyone who's been to a round of UN climate negotiations knows that at the end of the day, so much of it comes down to the enabling finance. So our responsibility here is twofold, threefold really. First of all, it's getting our own use of fossil fuels down as fast as possible. Secondly, it's addressing what is by far our biggest contribution to global climate change, which is our fossil fuel exports, and moving off coal and gas exports quickly to alternative clean exports. And thirdly, crucially, it is providing the finance and other support that the Pacific and other parts of the world need in order to fulfill their plans for moving away from fossil fuels to a cleaner future.
Yeah, well, we've seen how oil can be weaponized in the case of Cuba just in these last few months. So many shocking things have happened. Venezuela attacked, and now Cuba, the blockade increased by oil, any oil from Venezuela, Mexico, all being threatened and stopped. And I imagine a lot of the Pacific Islands are the same. They're island nations. They get ships arriving, tankers with oil to keep their electricity grid going. And that vulnerability, you know, has been answered in the case of Cuba. I've got another story in this show about the Chinese arriving with solar panels, even donating solar panels, but certainly low-cost solar panels to make that transition happen. You know, not bringing money as such, but bringing the actual wherewithal to transition. And that's what this conference is about, a transition. You think Australia is creative in that way, is able to be supportive in helping nations nearby transition, like East Timor, for example?
Well, we absolutely have the capability and the responsibility to do that. Now, Australia's a complicated story when it comes to cooperation on climate change because, you know, we are an important development partner to the Pacific. There are examples, and I know from years working at Oxfam in international development support, of really good collaborative efforts to support local community energy. And as you've highlighted, this is so important in terms of security, resilience, and self-determination. It's the great convenient truth about renewable energy. It provides all those things, and that's clearer now than ever. But we can and must do so much more there. There's an enormous unmet need for financial support, not only for renewable energy transitions, also for adapting to the impacts of climate change that can no longer be avoided, and also for addressing loss and damage from climate change, those impacts that owing to past inaction communities are now facing and need a way to be able to rebuild from. So I think there's been good examples of work there, but it has to be so much more because the crisis is now so urgent, and the benefits of the transition for communities, for security, for equality, for every sort of human development goal that we are pursuing, you know, are so clear. And what's really encouraging about the Santa Marta conference is it's so much in that spirit of working together. Nobody denies these challenges are difficult. Mm. I mean, Colombia itself is as dependent on fossil fuel revenue as Australia is, perhaps more. The Netherlands, the co-host, is also a fossil fuel producer. But they are recognizing that, look, we need to get off fossil fuels and we need to do this collaboratively because it absolutely depends on countries working together to break those shackles, to support each other, and to realize these opportunities between them. We understand that there will be some Australian presence in Santa Marta. We'd hope, of course, that the minister was going, especially given the role Australia has this year in partnership with the Pacific as president of negotiations for COP31. Because we can be such a big part of this solution. I mean, like Colombia, we're a major fossil fuel producer. We also are sitting on some tremendous opportunity, as yet untapped opportunity for renewable energy. And of course, the Pacific is the region of the world that really epitomizes both what's at stake from climate change, but what can be achieved through real determination and leadership. So, now, we want to see Australia working in partnership, in real partnership with the Pacific, but also collaboratively with the world at large.
Yeah, we had Kumi Naidoo on this program making a direct call
Fantastic.
to Chris Bowen. He said, I call on him. I want to see you there. And just you mentioned Colombia's dependence. It does export, and it's, however, it set a world example. Gustavo Petro, what a hero, you know, he has halted new fossil fuel exploration contracts. All the existing contracts will be honored, but no new contracts. And he's also halted mining in the Amazon region, which is now this biodiverse protected area, you know, very important, as you heard about in Belém. Do you think this example is unthinkable in Australia? And you mentioned the proportion. Colombia is 10% dependent, its GDP on that export. Australia is only 5%, from what I could search out this morning. Do you think that example is still unthinkable in Australia to do that radical shift?
Nothing's unthinkable, and I think we all need to work towards a national roadmap from away from fossil fuels. That's terrific. You've had Kumi Naidoo on giving that clarion call to Chris Bowen. I mean, absolutely support that, and huge regard for Kumi Naidoo's leadership on this front. Look, we have a choice, really. I say we, the Australian government. I mean, the future is beyond fossil fuels. This transition is going to happen. It's a question of whether it becomes very disruptive and difficult for Australian communities, with a lot of people being left behind, having a difficult future, or if we do it in a way that's carefully managed, where there's proactive support for workers and other affected communities, where we're having a managed wind down of fossil fuel production in line with what the science demands, and also embracing the new opportunities for clean energy. So, if I was the government at the moment, I'd be thinking, okay, how do we make sure Australian communities feel looked after and that they know we have their back? How do we ensure that everyone has confidence that they have a bright future? And how do we engage in a bit of just practical, prudent risk management at the moment when we know the world is changing, when we know our future looks different? And I think that means you've got to get on top of this. You need a pragmatic plan that both meets the urgency, but is also very practical in how communities are supported through the transition. I don't think that's unthinkable in the current context, because I think when it's approached that way, it can be a very politically attractive proposition, and one where all Australians really feel that the government has their back, and that we're going to tackle the urgency of the climate crisis. Of course, by now, the vast majority of Australians know in their gut. I mean, they've had a very visceral experience of the brute realities of climate change, know something needs to be done, have understandable fears, many people, about what their future looks like as we move beyond fossil fuels. And so, a national roadmap and active effort that we are seeing some countries like Colombia now pursue is something that should be, I think, very appealing, and an important active leadership globally, with Australia in the driving seat of negotiations, but also something that can give us much more confidence about the future.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high-quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Now here's Dr. Simon Bradshaw. We mentioned Chris Bowen. He's our climate change and energy minister, And he said at a recent Climate Week event that he was off to another Talanoa in the Pacific. And as he is president of negotiations, you mentioned that for COP31, he's responsible for setting the agenda. And I wonder, what do you think Pacific leaders will be telling him?
Well, that 1.5 degrees is really a survival limit for Pacific Island countries and an absolute imperative that needs to be the guiding star for the negotiations. And so that necessarily means a real focus on just getting emissions down in line with what the science demands. A key part of that, of course, the key part is getting off fossil fuels. So I would imagine he's hearing first and foremost, and this is where the Pacific's provided so much leadership, you know, that need to really get on top of the fossil fuel challenge, do that in line with limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. There will be a range of other very important issues, ensuring greater access to climate finance and other enabling supports within the Pacific, having a strong focus on the ocean climate nexus, so the role of the ocean in climate solutions, also the impacts of climate change on oceans, and really backing in that long history of Pacific climate leadership the Pacific region has fought very hard for many, many years through the process of UN climate negotiations, but through other means, including this landmark ruling from the International Court of Justice, which reaffirmed that, you know, doing everything possible to limit warming to 1.5 degrees is a legal obligation of countries. And in that context, new fossil fuel production could constitute an internationally wrongful act. So I think the priorities of the region are very clear. And our minister has pledged to approach COP31 and this role of negotiations president as a partnership with the Pacific, the best opportunity we have for strong, meaningful outcomes at this crucial moment is to really be elevating, backing in and respecting that leadership from the Pacific.
Yeah, well, I read a little bit about your recent trip to Palau, and I think a lot of it is about listening, and you're sort of talking, I think, in the spirit of this cooperativeness that we need, global cooperativeness, and that's very much the spirit of Santa Marta. They really want to bring people. I spoke to someone from the Netherlands, Bastiaan Hassing, and he said, look, this is going to be a safe space for people to talk. It's not part of the UN process. It's not going to be big decisions, gavels coming down and all that. It's going to be a safe space to tease out the roadmap. We really need to put our thinking hats on together globally. And as the Pacific people tell you, we're all in the same canoe. So I'd like to know a bit about the Pacific, some stories from the Pacific. I know you're very, Greenpeace is very involved with plastics in the ocean. And plastics, now we come to think of it, that goes straight back to the petrochemical industry, right back to that oil and gas. Can you connect the climate crisis with what people are saying in the Pacific, especially noticing those plastics floating about?
Of course. Well, let's maybe touch on plastics first of all, because a lot of the projections for possible expansion in petrochemical production over the coming years, next couple of decades, would be to support plastics. And so it's no surprise that one of the strongest backers of the plastics industry is the fossil fuel industry. And so these things are fundamentally connected. And having been privileged to spend some more time in the Pacific recently, one thing that strikes you is there is a radically holistic view of all of this. Ocean protection, climate protection, getting off plastics is really all seen as part of the same, you know, larger problem. And the solutions is very much the same. You know, it comes down to getting off fossil fuels. It comes down to that important cooperation and actionable solutions that you've talked about and working together. And I think holding on to that vision of a better future, where we are not so shackled to fossil fuels or to materialism, where we've rediscovered the importance of community, of our common values. And so it's quite, you know, radical in that sense, in not just the technical challenges, but really grounding the whole discussion in some very clear Pacific values and this approach of Talanoa that you've mentioned, of listening and working cooperatively towards solutions. I personally found it, you know, tremendously, you know, nourishing. And a great privilege to be, you know, part of some of those discussions, because not only does it highlight just what's at stake and the interconnections between these challenges, but also, you know, gives us a method and a lot of inspiration on how to approach it. And I think the Pacific's often still seen as somewhere that, yes, it's extremely vulnerable to climate impacts, but increasingly we are now seeing the, you know, the power of that leadership because of how practical it is, because it recognizes the interconnection of these challenges, but because it's so grounded in a very clear, longstanding, you know, set of values and in this method of Talanoa for coming together, overcoming differences to be able to deal with them.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. And I hope this Santa Marta conference is well reported. You know, I don't think there's been much buzz about it yet in the media. And I really think it's groundbreaking. At last, having a conference where those fossil fuel blockers and spoilers are sort of kept out. Well, they won't want to even go there. A lot of countries are petro states, aren't they? It's not just companies that would intrude. But I'm hoping COP31 will be different too. Could you perhaps I've got one more question, but at COP30, my understanding was the petrostates really blocked 85 other countries who wanted a roadmap, at least a roadmap on forests and a roadmap on fossil fuels, but they blocked that. So is COP31 going to be any different?
Well, we can hope. But I think a couple of things to mention here. As you've highlighted, I mean, the conference in Santa Marta it's very practical. It's people coming together, not getting bogged in the politics, but, you know, willing countries engaging in really strong collaboration around, you know, these challenges and opportunities that can really see us through this crisis. The COP is an inherently more political process and has always been hampered by the fact that it works on a consensus decision model, which is both its strength because it gives it its legitimacy. It's an all-in process where everybody has a seat at the table, but it also means that you can have one or two petrostates, and Australia's obviously got a very checkered history within the process where they can really hold things up and cause a world of pain for everyone else. So COP31 is going to have those same challenges. And it's why it's so important that I think we now have these two tiers, these two streams of action. We have to continue with that process of all-in UN climate negotiations. Perhaps there's some possibility for reform, so it's not quite so log-jammed. Our minister undoubtedly faces a difficult challenge in helping shepherd a new consensus decision around fossil fuels with everyone on board. I mean, I'd hope, given the moment we're in globally and just how important that's demonstrated, getting off fossil fuels is for, you know, security reasons, that perhaps out of this difficult time, we might see some kind of real progress. But I think for the time being, the next many years, it's probably going to have to be two things at once. That process of UN negotiations will still be important, but just as important, these efforts by willing countries, like we're going to see through Santa Marta, like we're seeing through the efforts of the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative, that's going to be so important in actually driving real progress and implementation. It'll also send a strong political signal back into the COP. But I think beyond that, we're still going to have these efforts that'll come out of Santa Marta. There's plans already for a second conference in the Pacific next year, I believe, which will build even more and may even see the launch of a new sort of collaborative, cooperative instrument for moving off fossil fuels. We'll wait and see. So I think we're in a more complicated world now where we have a few things going on that collectively are going to deliver more progress than what the very difficult but important process of UN climate negotiations has delivered alone.
Yeah, well, I'm hopeful too that those two streams will go on, especially because civil society is included in that, and all, you know, Indigenous people and people who have got a different story to tell. As it was in Belém, we saw that the Amazon people had a very different story to tell. And it all feeds in. It's got to be acknowledged. It's got to be. And also the Santa Marta people said, well, we welcome that because the civil society is often way ahead of governments, pushing and more ambitious. So all the big organizations like Greenpeace, but there's many others. Just to finish, I was so elated to hear about this conference, but then all these shocks since the beginning of this year, first Venezuela, then Cuba, then Iran. This is just very, very shocking to world democracy. You know, the impunity with which we've seen, you know, Gaza and Palestine is just, you sort of feel, what a international court of justice, what's the United Nations, what are all these big instruments doing? You know, they seem to have no bite or not enough bite. But Bill McKibben said something I really liked. He said, sunlight travels 93 million miles to reach the Earth, and not one of those miles is through the Straits of Hormuz. And I thought that was a pithy way of saying, look, let's embrace that renewable energy just because it won't cause so much pain as the previous model. Could you just finish with some words of encouragement to all the climate action listeners, you know?
That was a great quote, wasn't it, Vivian? And I saw a similar quote from the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, about how renewables can't be weaponized, that you cannot blockade the sun. You don't have price spikes when it comes to the wind. So it's an extremely confronting moment. And when I reflect back to 10 years ago in Paris, and that all-important breakthrough with the Paris Agreement, you know, as imperfect as it is, you know, it was still a remarkable step. And I don't think anyone expected or predicted that 10 years on, we'd be where we are now, which is the painful part, and that we would, you know, still have, you know, climate denialists in some government around the world, that we would be seeing these, you know, terrible, you know, imperialist invasions and, you know, old power lashing out in this way. I think it is true that, you know, the darkest hour comes before the dawn. I think that we do, when we look, see incredible seeds for optimism, even in times of such turmoil and suffering. And I think the Santa Marta Conference is one of those, because I think when we look at the world at large at the moment, is there anything more important than like-minded communities, civil society organizations, governments, experts coming together in good faith, in a Talanoa spirit, and thinking about how together do we work our way through this problem. I think there is a very bright future at the end of that. I think what Bill McKibben said there and others is absolutely true. You know, renewables do offer the path to peace and prosperity, as well as dealing with the climate crisis. And I think coming together, working like this in important but practical ways is probably the most hopeful and encouraging thing that we can do at the moment, and just hang on to that vision of a brighter future that we know is possible. As a global organization, we have, of course, people working in Ukraine and in parts of the Middle East and North Africa with tremendous courage at the moment. But some of their response has been precisely this. You know, it's brought home to them how fossil fuel dependence really heightens vulnerability in these moments. And sometimes it's at the root cause of the conflicts they're dealing with. And so they're working harder than ever to build the energy systems of the future, because they are so freeing in that sense. And when I've heard some Pacific colleagues talk about this vision of a fossil fuel free Pacific, it's in that same spirit as well. This is essential to dealing with climate change, but this is the path that is going to create a better, stronger, more stable and peaceful future for all. So the solutions are there, as Bill McKibben's made beautifully, poetically clear. Working together in this moment to bring that future about in a way that leaves everyone stronger.
Marvellous. Thank you very much, Simon. And the thing is, around the world, 89% or 90% of people really want this. They want climate action, but they seem to not know that other people want it too. They seem to, especially the media tells a different story of, you know, marvellously exciting conflict. But really, these solutions to me are far more interesting. And thank you so much for embodying them and talking to us so beautifully today about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vivian. Really enjoyed the chat. Thank you.
When you compare an old growth forest compared to a forest which is regrowing after a disturbance like logging, they're actually quite different ecosystems. Generally, like older, wetter forests slow down the path of fire, and this is actually quite a well-known phenomenon. Historically, these big, large fires have been quite rare, but what we've seen in the last 20 years is they're becoming quite a lot more common. So we've had 3 in the last 20 years. This is definitely because of climate change, which is making our ecosystems a lot drier and the fire weather more intense.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
This song is by David Rovix, about the moment we're in when Cuba is being starved and its hospitals deprived of fuel and medication. It's called Starving Us for Liberty.
It's been 3 months since the blockade was imposed on the island. With no fuel, the world afraid to try to sell any to them. No fuel to run the hospitals for electrical stations. No fuel to run the water pumps. Blackouts across the nation. To get at the government, are you starving us for liberty? Or is it for democracy? Are you killing us in order to make us free? What is it that they want? The question just reverberates. What drives the leaders of this country? The United States. Why do they think the world is all part of their domain? Will we ever throw off the shackles of the American reign? Are you starving us for liberty? Or is it
actor Rosie Wiley reading Bill McKibben's article about Cuba. As the war in Iran expands, we need to think strategically about the transition from oil and gas to renewable energy. Bill McKibben has written an article called Surviving on Trump's Dangerous Planet, and I've asked actor Rosie Wiley to read it for us. Rosie.
Yet another war, and yet another argument for an end to oil. For what seems like the 50th time in my long life, the US, with Israel, has attacked another nation, as per usual, without an honest debate in Congress. As the oil executives helpfully explained to Politico last month, they are generously prepared to be a stabilizing force in Iran, should the regime fall. Indeed, they'd rather do it there than in Venezuela because, as executives explain, Iran's oil industry, despite being ravaged by years of US sanctions, is still considered to be structurally sound, unlike that of Venezuela's. Let's look for a moment at Cuba, which seems like it might well be next on the Trump hit list. After cutting off Venezuelan supplies, he's also pressured Mexico to stop sending crude to Havana. As a result, he explained, they have no money, they have no anything right now, which is largely true. Things in Havana have grown desperate in the last few weeks as Washington has tightened the screws they've been turning for decades. Now, the overwhelming problem is energy. And it's here that something else quite profound has been happening. An almost unbelievable surge in the production of solar power. As The Economist reported on Thursday, Mr. Trump is obsessed with oil, but Cuba has been building out an alternative source of energy supply at record pace, solar panels imported from China. According to Chinese export data compiled by Ember, a think tank, in the 12 months to April 2025, Cuba's imports of Chinese solar panels grew by a factor of 34, faster than anywhere else in the world. The island has gone from having almost no solar power a few years ago to levels which help it cope with Mr. Trump's embargo. The regime's energy policy is mostly responsible for the boom. In March 2024, the government announced a plan to build 2 gigawatts of solar power plants by 2028. It depends heavily on China for funding and construction, as well as for the solar panels themselves. On February 11th, the government claimed that its new solar plants generated almost a gigawatt of power during the lunchtime peak. Enough in that moment to meet the electricity needs of a third of the country. With their help, life of a sort stumbles on. Most people can't afford their own panels, of course, unless they have relatives abroad who can send them dollars. But private businesses often can. And on Thursday, the government offered new tax breaks for businesses that undertake new renewable energy projects. Perhaps in response, the Trump administration said on Friday that it would allow small oil sales to private businesses. China has solar panels to sell for cheap, and once they're up, your lifeline is the sun. And unlike the oil terminals, there's really no good way to strike at solar energy because it's inherently decentralized. That's clearly the story from Ukraine, which has weathered Putin's assault on its energy infrastructure by building a new, harder to attack infrastructure. Wind and solar arrays with independent transmission lines are scattered over the landscape, which makes them harder to hit and easier to repair. A coal power station is a large single target that a single missile could take out. You would need around 40 missiles to do the equivalent amount of capacity damage at a wind farm. Solar too makes an unattractive target. Attacking decentralized solar power installations is not economically rational. Missiles and drones are expensive, and significantly disrupting such systems would require a large number of strikes, while the overall impact on the energy system would remain limited. Both solar and wind parks can function even when parts of them are out of operation. China has obviously figured out all these lessons. It foresaw the attacks on Venezuela and Iran, two of its big suppliers of crude, and began to dramatically increase its oil stockpile. But of course, it's done something much more important: build out the unembargoable supply of electrons that come most easily and cheaply from the sun and wind. Since 2021, China has added more power capacity across all energy technologies than the US has in its history, including 543 gigawatts last year, according to figures released late last month by the country's National Energy Administration. None of this is about ideology. China, Cuba, the US, Venezuela, Iran, all suffer from democratic deficits at this point. A sad list for an American to have to compile. It's about power, in both meanings of that word. And it's about survival. As the rest of us imagine rebuilding a world that might actually work for its inhabitants. We have a few humble but powerful tools. The solar panel, the windmill, the battery, that make it easier to imagine something other than our current nightmare.
Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón que tiene latir de bombo, color de vino ancestral. Viene tu cueca de lucha cabalgando un viento austral. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero.
Gallego Region, Gunnerman. This is Stephen Pigram from up Broomway, Yawuru Country, and it's great to be down in Melbourne and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio. Been here for a long time.
Where I belong.
Here's the Honourable Chris Bowen, not going to Santa Marta, but we'll make certain he hears all about it.
And really I have a couple of key themes to touch on in a short period of time. The first one is progress. Steady, deliberate, careful progress is what gets the job done. And it's progress our country is making. You know, last quarter, the first quarter in Australian history that we hit 51% renewable energy. And that happened like going broke, slowly and then quickly. It's hard work, it's grind, it's years of work, and then you see the dividends and you see us move from September being the first month where renewables provided more energy than coal to then that final quarter being the first quarter in which renewables provided more energy than everything else. And that's progress, which is built in the garages and the driveways and the roofs of Australians and in the areas of regional Australia who seize the opportunities, who take the opportunities. I know if you read some newspapers, you think everyone in regional Australia hates climate action and everyone in the inner cities loves climate action. It is a lie. But firstly, let me just talk about the households, because that is one thing that Governor Newsom and I have discussed a few times. We're no poster child in Australia. We've made plenty of mistakes. One thing we understand is that the road to net zero runs through households. And the fact that as of this morning, 265,000 Australian households have put in a home battery since 1 July. It took us 10 years and 8 months to put in the second 6 gigawatt hours of household storage. That's the Australian journey, which is being undertaken in the outer suburbs and regions, not so much the inner cities. When I did this policy announcement, people came out, the usual suspects, and said, this is for the rich inner city elites. It is not true. Take one electorate by random example, one of my favourite electorates in Australia, Dixon, in the outer suburbs of Brisbane. They have installed, the good people of Dixon, three times more battery, or more batteries, or another way, more batteries than the seats of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane combined, the three inner city seats. The electorate of Dixon. This is a regional and outer suburban story, not an inner city story. Why? Because Australians in regional and outer suburban know that what's good for their pocket is good for the planet. They do believe in climate action, but they also believe in reducing their energy bills. And they know that too when it comes to EV take-up. Again, I live in the western suburbs of Sydney. I see EVs all around me, every day. Suburban Australians taking them up. And I'm glad that since we've come to office, we've increased sales from 2% to 14%. Much more to do, much more to do. But progress, again, being driven by Australians every single day. And again, this is a story, too, of regional Australia when it comes to large scale. Now, I don't pretend to you that this is easy or there aren't real issues of community benefit and community consultation that we need, all need to do better on. We have worked hard to improve, and we always need to improve to ensure that communities are properly consulted and benefit. But again, last December I did a tour, take an electorate, a random electorate. I didn't know what was about to happen, but I did a tour of Farrer in southwest New South Wales. You know, I went into Hay Council. You never quite know what you're doing, what you're walking into when you go into a council meeting. You could get anything. Met with the councillors, you know, graziers, a female mayor, but every other councillor was male. You know, very traditional, conservative community. And you brace yourself for the incoming, and they said, look, we've got a few issues to raise with you. Is there any chance we could make the renewable energy zone bigger? And we're a bit worried this new transmission line's going in is not big enough. I mean, this is no exaggeration. Now, again, I don't pretend that there aren't, that respect reflects every single household in rural Australia, every single community, but it reflects more than what you think reading some newspapers. So all this is steady progress. So this gives me confidence, while there's a long, long way to go, that our 82% renewable target is in reach. Not inevitable. If we make the wrong policy decisions in coming years, then we won't get there. But with the right continued policy calibration, we can, and I'm confident will, get to 82% renewables, which from 33% in 2022, in just 8 years, will be a remarkable national achievement. And that helps us get to the 43% emissions reduction. And finally, the 62 to 70 emissions reduction, which the Independent Climate Change Authority has set us as a target accepted by the Cabinet. Not easy to do. Secondly, we meet in a period of great international instability. We all know that, and great international tragedy. But it remains the case that the one form of energy which Vladimir Putin or a Middle Eastern crisis cannot interrupt is the flow of sun and the flow of wind. That cannot be interrupted. My final message is this is a big year for Australia and for the Pacific. President of COP negotiations for COP31, this is our chance. It will require a lot of hard work. I will be spending a lot of time this year talking to people with whom I don't necessarily on the face of it agree, because you don't get a successful negotiation by talking to people you agree with all the time. But this is our chance to take issues that the Pacific has been trying to get on the agenda for 20 years and have been unable to get onto the COP agenda, And I undertake to do that. And next week, I have the Talanoa, I think my fifth Talanoa with Pacific climate ministers about planning COP31. I can tell you that the relationship with Turkey is in good shape, and we are working well together, as we should and must, to deliver a successful COP31. Progress has been made. We've done a lot. I'm pleased with what we've done so far. Am I satisfied? No. Should you be satisfied? No. Should be pleased, but not yet satisfied, because that keeps us hungry for more, which is exactly what we're going to do. Thanks for your time today.
My name's Daryl Best. I worked all my working career in coal mines. I am now passionate about a transition to renewables and about saving our planet. And you are listening to the Climate Action Radio Show on Community Radio. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Canta, canta, compañero, que tu voz sea disparo, que con las manos del pueblo no habrá canto desarmado. Canta, canta, compañero, canta, canta, compañero. Canta, canta, compañero, que no calle tu canción. Si te falta bastimento, tienes ese corazón.
Thanks for listening to the Climate Action Show called We Are All in the Same Canoe on the Sea to Santa Marta. You heard Dr. Simon Bradshaw from Greenpeace and David Rovick's song, Starving Us for Liberty. Thank you to Chris Bowen, speaking at the Climate Week in Sydney, and Rosie Wiley reading Bill McKibben's article. Thanks to the panel at Covering Climate Now on the climate impacts of war in Iran. The details will be in the show notes, attached to Climate Action Show 3CR. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.